Thank you very much, Walter. I'm not sure that I can meet some of your comments. It's tough being the last lecturer of a long day. And instead of giving a concluding lecture, I think I give a summary because so many of the things have already been said. But I'm not really going to have a multimedia show here today. I'm trying to talk very seriously about the implications of what's happening in the electronic age with respect to what's happening in the universities. And trying not to offend anybody, but perhaps taking the path which many people don't take, I decided to write a letter. Dear Dell, what a pleasure it is to be here today at this wonderful celebration in your honor. You know how grateful I am to you, but the rest of the audience may not know the role that you played. Many years ago, during the volatile 60s, this wide-eyed, bushy-tailed, adventuresome faculty member got turned on by computer graphics. But no one wanted to be involved. No department was receptive. Architecture thought it was too technical. Engineering thought it would be useless to draw pretty pictures with a machine. Computer science, just getting started, was not interested. And you encouraged me to persevere, to write a proposal to the NSF, and if funded, you and Provost Don Cook committed to establish a center, the Program of Computer Graphics. You even provided matching funds in very difficult economic times. Little did I know how that decision would change my life. But more importantly, how that decision has provided opportunities for thousands of Cornellians and hundreds of graduate students, ones who have taught computer graphics at MIT, Carnegie Mellon, Princeton, Harvard, Stanford, Washington, and Caltech, just to name a few, ones who have won Hollywood Oscars, and ones who have become Microsoft millionaires. Graphics is now commonplace, the only user interface on most computer systems. And fortunately, today, the teaching of this subject is now institutionalized at Cornell, and I might add, in a variety of forms in many departments. Your foresight was impeccable, and I am forever thankful. But I'm now concerned about our future in the information age, about the abilities of research universities to play a leadership role, about the structure and flexibility of our institutions, the time it takes to respond, and the real difficulties with interdisciplinary education. To put things in perspective, no pun intended from a graphics professor, let us first examine the rate of progress in the computer industry. Can I have the first slide, please? But I think I will need the light so I can read my lectures. This is the only equation you got during the day. This is one which describes Moore's law, and you don't have to look at the math. Moore's law originally stated that chip density, the number of transistors per unit area on a chip, would double each year. This was later modified to a doubling every 18 months. Basically, if you work through the numbers, in 15 years, we get 1,000 times the processing power. Next slide, please. And with increasing chip density comes increasing processor speed, compounding the increase in processing power. At this rate, by 2010, a microprocessor, roughly the complexity of today's Pentium 3, can I have the next slide, please, will cost $4 to manufacture, and a gigabyte of memory will be $10. Amazing, isn't it? And there are doubters. People have been skeptical of this continued rate of change for more than two decades, but Moore's law has held true. The National Semiconductor Research Association, the group which sets the technology roadmap just for the $150 billion chip industry to be competitive, just 2 weeks ago stated that this growth will continue for at least 15 more years. Yes, there will be some technical hurdles, perhaps as soon as 5 years from now. But there are many alternative paths, even though at this stage the technology is pressing the molecular and atomic limits. At this growth rate, memory chips of 2014 will have 64 billion transistors and microprocessors will run at 3.6 gigahertz. Understanding Moore's law. It's hard to understand all of these numbers. But let me try with two illustrations. May I have the next slide, please? This one just is a plot showing the growth in transistor density, or processing power, if you wish, in the next 18 months. And what's significant is that red area is equal in size to the blue area, which means in the next 18 months, we will have as much computer power generated and produced as existed in the entire previous history of the computing industry. Next slide, please. And perhaps this is even more relevant to the honoree who's so interested in photography. This is one of Edgerton's slides. And I use this in my introductory course in disruptive technology in the business school. Basically, one that says, on a standard desktop 500 megahertz Pentium 3, how many instructions can be computed in the time it takes this bullet to go through the apple? And today, it's 50,000. And tomorrow, 2014, it's going to be 50 million instructions in that amount of time. What will we do with all of this power? When already most of us only use a very small fraction of the power available on our desktop, email, word processing, Excel spreadsheets, and surfing the web don't come close. The cost of processing and memory and storage will be insignificant, and it will be cheaper to replace the components than to fix them. The major challenge for Intel and AMD and others is not in the manufacturing of better and faster chips, although they have to continue this trend, but in creating new markets which demand this processing glut. Next slide, please. It's not the numbers which are important. The famous Dutch computer scientist Dijkstra once said, a baby, in the upper left, crawls at 1 mile per hour. A person runs at 10 miles per hour. A car drives at 100 miles per hour, and a plane flies at 1,000 miles per hour. Each of these rates represents an order of magnitude, 10x, increase from one to the next. But it's not so much that they increase by a power of 10, but the change in the world, which is visible because of the change. And bandwidth is even increasing at a faster rate, now doubling every 8 months. Witness the amount of fiber being laid around the globe and the subsequent reduction in long-distance phone charges. On an abstract level, communication will exist from any place to any place, and it will be video and text in addition to voice. In the words of the New Zealand actress Anna Pekin in her telecom advertisement, there is no more there. There is only here. The internet already provides an infinite encyclopedia, a global library at your fingertips. And in a commercial sense, it is a disintermediator, reducing the friction between the buyer and the seller, the consumer and the manufacturer. In this mostly unregulated environment, and I emphasize the word unregulated, since it really occurred without government intervention, without bureaucracy, without ownership of turf, the problems will not be technical. Of course, we will always want more bandwidth, but we will have access to information, although it may be difficult to separate the wheat from the chaff, and the Dewey Decimal System will have been supplanted by the search engines of Ask Jeeves, Lycos, Excite, Yahoo, and others. Our new problems are not ones of technology, they are ones of privacy, protection of intellectual property, authenticity, and veracity of information. A photograph may no longer be valid evidence in a courtroom. Next slide, please. Let us look at this non-existent theater, modeled and rendered by a Cornell undergraduate architecture student. Never existed, and done by somebody who didn't know how to use the machine. And if we look a little bit closer, we can note Pavarotti's replacement. Can I have the next slide, please? Rehearsing on stage in his younger years, although there are members of his family who, despite all of your versatility, Dale, claim that this is an impossibility. On a more serious note, how will this, or maybe more pertinent, how should this electronic environment change the modus operandi of the research universities of the 21st century? I don't pretend to have any answers, but I wish to make some observations and compare university behavior to industry behavior. And let us look at several examples and note the differences. The first example which I take, which was written up in Microprocessor Report a few months ago, relates to strategy. How industry decides what to produce, the early stages of the design process. With linear growth rates, it's relatively easy to predict the demand, the costs, and even the required performance. The automotive industry can determine the required miles per gallon 5 years out. Utilities can estimate power demand, and school systems can anticipate student enrollments well in advance. But how are leading-edge microprocessor digital electronic products planned? Executives, designers, engineers meet to determine performance, estimate cost, and the design schedules and testing and implementation and production. Can I have the next slide, please? In the computer industry today, design cycles through production time is between 24 and 36 months. Inputs to the decision are the current competitive state of the industry, estimated consumer performance demand, associated or relevant other components, monitor resolution, bandwidth, etc., and Moore's Law. We have to be above Moore's Law. And in theory, engineers work 36 months, as shown on this time scale, to build a microprocessor that lies above Moore's Law's curve. Note, in theory, there is no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. Competition might do better. Project completion time might slip. So they set the goal well above the curve. And everybody's enthusiastic and optimistic. Can the engineers meet the performance specifications? Generally not. When considering the implementation details, the compromise decisions, the cost of components, and perhaps missing technologies, we get the inevitable emergence of the gap. Can I have the next slide, please? The gap is not a clothing store. It's the difference between the PowerPoint performance, what executives tell each other and their customers, and the actual performance. When the gap is too large, there is turmoil in the project. Schedules slip, performance goals are renegotiated, and we have to stretch out the development time. Both performance expectations are lowered, the schedule is lengthened, and this may happen two or three times. Next slide, please. But once it appears that the target will be below Moore's Law, morale problems occur. Finger pointing, competitive and proud engineers leave, etc. What are the business management issues and problems associated to this? First, the executives are the last to know. They're tracking the PowerPoint performance. Can you kill the project? It's probably too late. Why? There's been a marketing blitz. Reputations, possible revenue loss. There's need for development platforms for future designs, so they can't stop it. Problem number two, in today's industry, because of the rapidly increasing rates, the product development cycle time is greater than the product shelf life time. The latter is a function of competitor performance, market demand, or need to operate at the high end of the performance level because that's the high margin end of the market. When throughput time is less than the shelf life time, there's a need to pipeline. That is, run several production cycles in parallel. Next slide, please. It's not unusual in the computer industry to have three or four designs going simultaneously. And note, here we go, the cycle starts again. The key to success is correctly setting the goals, the performance objectives, perfect execution, and perhaps most important, crisp and fast decision making. And here is where I have some concerns. Universities are and should be democratic institutions. Many recommendations are made by committee, and decisions are made in the spirit of compromise. However, what I personally most admire about Silicon Valley is that the culture is not risk adverse. Failure is not a stigma. Decisions by compromise inherently lower project goals. May I have the next slide, please? So we end up with our project, and we end up with changing our project goal because of compromise. Perhaps even worse is the duration of the decision making. With committee reports, department, college, university, and trustee approval, the decision making time may even exceed the implementation time, no less than the shelf life time. In an exponentially changing world, next slide please, this is disaster. And we will always be followers. Is this our educational destiny? Well, can we provide more authority to a president or to a provost without having the backlash of the faculty? David Packard of Hewlett-Packard had an adage, ready, fire, aim. Maybe, just maybe, the major impact of Moore's law is not the computer power, but the compression of time. Regulatory structures. Rule of law is the foundation of our country and our prosperity. But in the computer industry, we have found that overspecification of rules and standards just doesn't work. The internet is this best example of this mostly unregulated environment. In the beginning, there were only two rules. Anyone could say anything, and nothing was official. Basically, no rules. And except for establishing open standards, that same philosophy holds true today. As soon as rules were made to try and overly specify or overly constrain the system, difficulties arose. Of course, we should not allow pornography on the web or provide a safe harbor for terrorists or drugs. We'll never be separate from the operating system, despite the rulings of Judge Jackson. And dismemberment of AT&T into the regional Bell operating systems also separated service from content. I am not advocating monopolistic power. Both AT&T and Microsoft were guilty of monopolistic practices. But today we are attempting to rebuild the dismantled telephone system, to merge the long distance carriers with the local exchange suppliers. And AOL is extremely successful in providing both service and content. Look at the Glass-Steagall Act, finally revoked. Now Citigroup can offer one-stop shopping, and one company can provide insurance, banking, and stock brokerage. The trend is towards aggregation, not disaggregation, towards systems and integration. In contrast, universities have been moving in the other direction. In the 1970s and 1980s, the trend was to put individual colleges on their own bottom. Since college faculty are vying for their own share of the university budget, out-of-college electives have been diminished. Look at the recent decisions of our own arts and science college faculty restricting the allowable number of out-of-college electives. In the past, computer graphics was not even co-listed as an engineering course until it was recognized, because of the change in the budget structure, that the architecture college was receiving financial returns for thousands of credit hours taken by computer science and electrical engineering students. Curricula are primarily set by individual departments with rubber stamp approval by college and university faculty. To paraphrase President Kennedy, is it not time for us to ask not what the university can do for us, but what we can do for the university? Should we not be relaxing our requirements, encouraging cross-pollination, and providing more freedom for students to set their own curriculum? Forget about who gets the credit for the credit hours. Just as the computer industry is moving from components to systems, so should we allow the integration of different disciplines. The next point is the influence and importance of the consumer. I have already documented the well-known trajectories of the computer industry. Suffice it to repeat that with the exponential decrease in costs, there is a concomitant commoditization of the computer software hardware industry. With the ubiquity of computing and the emergence of the appliance age, computers will be more noticeable by their absence than by their presence. Just look at the technology adoption cycle as described by Jeffrey Moore in his book, Crossing the Chasm. Next slide, please. We are now at the early majority stage. The importance of this diagram is not the growth rates, which obviously increases from the start, levels out, and then diminishes with time, nor is it the increasing numbers of users as we proceed from the innovator and laboratory curiosity stage to the late stage, or late majority. The important fact, it is no longer the computer scientists and the electrical engineers who are the majority using the systems, but the common folk, from grade school to retirement, across all income brackets and all occupations. And as the commoditization continues, the major contribution, I hope, is made by the user, the creativity of the web designer, the imagination of the animator, the concepts of the architect, the ingenuity of the engineer, the diagnostic skills of the doctor, and the intellect of the author. The technology is there, is necessary, but no longer dominant, and perhaps not even visible. But the technology is changing, and changing at very rapid rates. And as previously stated, the changes will open up new vistas, new ideas, and new opportunities. And it is incumbent upon a first-rate research university to teach, at least in the science and technology areas, but probably all the areas of the university, not what is, but will be, to educate our students, not for today, which is what community colleges can do, but for the future. As hockey star Wayne Gretzky stated, his achievements occurred not because of his skating skill, but because of his innate ability to skate to where the puck will be. In this scenario, where it is necessary to know the future, one which is based on technological change, but one which the served constituency is not a homogeneous body, and certainly not one predominantly composed of the proverbial geeks and nerds, who should teach our future students? And it is my belief that it must be faculty who are skilled in computer technology, ones pushing the state of the art, ones who are creating the future, but also ones who are motivated by the needs of the consumer and interact with the diverse disciplines of the university. In this sense, computer science must address a much broader computer community than the past. And I applaud the president and the Provost for establishing the new Faculty of Computer and Information Science at this great university. This will be a necessary ingredient for maintaining our leadership position in the information age. Which leads me to my last analogy: virtual universities and real boundaries. And here I have three major points. The first is the definition of the Cornell experience and its duration. In the world of e-commerce, successful entities have repeat customers. Service providers do almost anything to keep their subscribers. A major goal is to reduce the churn rate, the number of users who leave, as the cost of replacement is exceedingly high. In fact, most of these dot-com companies spend an excessive amount of money on advertising to attract or maintain customers. The more customers, the more eyeballs. The more eyeballs, the greater the advertising revenues. And the greater the advertising revenues, the higher the stock price. It's insanity. It is said that the ultimate successful e-company is one which sells $1 bills for 85 cents and makes its profit from advertising. I am not suggesting that this should be the goal of an Ivy League university. But we should strive to retain our customers and provide a lifetime education for all of the students who spend so much on tuition during 4 or 5 years in Ithaca. In a rapidly changing world, it is difficult to stay up to date, more so now in the computer age than any other time period in history. Couple this with the fact that the average longevity with a single employer is rapidly declining. In Silicon Valley, the churn rate is so high, new hires average about 9 months. With all these changes, why not offer a lifetime education? The internet will allow us this capability and has the added benefit, if there are development officers in this room, of keeping our alumni very actively involved. Which brings me to my second point, distance learning. And perhaps now I talk of distance learning in a different way than other people have talked about it. The internet can eliminate the physical boundaries of our classroom. The classroom of the future can be virtual. Whether we are in the same physical location or not, we can place the lecturer or lecturers, as well as the entire class, in the same virtual space. So seen from any place, it looks the same. May I have the next slide, please? Now, this doesn't really show this, but this starts to give you an idea of the virtual space we already have in our laboratory in Rhodes Hall. There is great concern about losing the classroom experience, the ambiance of our learning environment. But we can maintain most of this technologically today, and certainly with increasing bandwidths, and we will be able to do so in the future. Characteristics we must maintain are the eye-to-eye contact between faculty and student, the ability for everybody to witness any and all interchanges, and the full and natural manner for interaction, a participatory as contrasted to passive experience. We can do most of this now, and at the Program of Computer Graphics, we have been giving joint seminars with 5 universities participating simultaneously with 2 video windows, plus separate channels for text, slides, and simulations, and computer control at each site, and we have been doing this since 1992. Yet we can hope for much more. Rather than duplicate the blackboard, we can have shared whiteboards with multiple users. We can bring the laboratory to the class rather than the other way around. And if the laboratory doesn't exist, we can simulate the behavior. And if I had a video projector here or more time, I would show you some of this on video, but I don't have that luxury right now, so please excuse the non-multimedia presentation. But imagine how science teaching in the K-12 level could be improved if we brought the San Francisco Exploratorium to every inner city grade school, free of charge. We already have the concept of universal service for the telephone system in the United States. Why shouldn't we provide universal broadband service for every kindergarten and every high school and every university in this country? There is a considerable amount of negativism about distance learning. It's too passive, like watching TV. It costs too much. How do we maintain our campus experience? It takes too long to prepare the lecture material. What is the reward system? Why not talk about how we may better provide our information delivery? What we can do with this new technology if we took advantage of what it will be, instead of worrying about cost or tuition or difficulties. Because with all of the awesome computer power and available bandwidth, we will ultimately be able to provide an excellent conduit for the delivery of lecture material. Should we do this? I believe the answer is yes, yes, and yes. And like the strategy discussion with respect to setting goals in an exponentially changing world, we need to start now. No, yesterday. The early bird gets the worm. We need to be a leader, not a follower. Maybe Ezra Cornell's adage of "I would found an institution where any person can find instruction in any study" is no longer possible to support alone. But if we had the critical mass and expertise in one area, we can partner with a sister institution in another. And if we wait, no, well, we shouldn't wait. It's well known that one of Cornell's greatest strengths is its beautiful Ithaca campus and exquisite rural surroundings. It's also well known that one of Cornell's greatest weaknesses is its beautiful Ithaca campus and exquisite rural surroundings. As previously stated this morning, centrally isolated. Why study law or business or computer science or architecture in such a rural setting, away from the action? But if we can bring the expertise of the financial community in New York City, London, and Tokyo, the policy experience of Washington, and the technology strategy of San Francisco to the Johnson School, we can improve our business education. Interaction with the vitality and entrepreneurship of Silicon Valley would only be beneficial to engineering. And working collaboratively on real projects with firms in urban areas would make our architectural education much more relevant and diverse. The Internet of tomorrow makes all of this possible. Are we not moving too slowly? And last, the problems associated with interdisciplinary studies. And maybe this subject is most dear to my heart. Interdisciplinary, a frequently used term, which in reality is accompanied by many unseen obstacles. Yet the most exciting research areas of tomorrow are those that exist at the fringes, something also previously stated today. In no man's land, at the boundaries between disciplines, why do we have such difficulties in creating truly interdisciplinary activities? I have personally witnessed the frustrations of hundreds of Cornell undergraduates, if not thousands, who want to take interdisciplinary paths. Maybe it's because I am a maverick, but more probably because the field of computer graphics is truly interdisciplinary. Students come to me who want computer graphics and theater design. They want education in electronic art. They want computer-aided architectural design. They want to learn about machine animation in the film industry. They need computer graphics and molecular modeling, computer graphics and protein synthesis, astrophysics and graphics simulations, finite element analysis with graphical input and output, and all our areas which are dependent upon both discipline-specific knowledge and computer science knowledge. And admittedly, at Cornell, we are fortunate to have some excellent options today. The College Scholars Program in the Arts and Sciences College, and the Engineering College Program in Engineering, and of course the Graduate School, all provide excellent options. But these options are not well publicized to the undergraduates and are not yet mainstream. The internet has been a commercial success because it disintermediates. It reduces the friction between buyers and sellers, and in so doing, eliminates the middleman. Because of its open standards, anyone or any company can participate. In the future, as more intelligence is added to the network, solutions will be simultaneously broader and deeper. In a sense, the remarkable aspect about the internet is that it has broken down the barriers surrounding the individual activities. How can universities of the next millennium learn from this? The internet fosters collaboration, yet joint appointments are exceedingly difficult to achieve, particularly before tenure promotion. The internet provides for flexible options, yet students are constrained by excessive requirements. The reward system is biased by the inherent loyalties to individual units as contrasted to the university. Jack Welsh of GE rewards his executives not just for their division performance, but for what they do for other divisions. What would happen in the University of Tomorrow if there were no departments or no colleges, and all faculty were part of one university grouped only by like intellectual pursuits? Now that would be truly interdisciplinary. Maybe this is what Ezra Cornell really meant when he said, any person can find instruction in any study. Dale, I have high hopes that Cornell can address these challenges of the electronic age and maintain its leadership position among the great university research universities of the next century. And I repeat, I am forever grateful that because of your support for interdisciplinary activities, I have had this wonderful experience. I feel like the surfer who was caught the once-in-a-lifetime wave, except mine has never stopped. Congratulations, and thank you again.